All right, good morning. This is about 2:41, and it is Tuesday, February 9th. And guess what? What's in a week? Yeah, your first test is a week from today. So hopefully you guys are kind of on schedule with your studying. You got the exam study guides, right? So that's what I can tell you. That's my best advice on how to prepare for the exam. All right, so if it says look at the question at the end of the chapter, make sure you're familiar with that question, okay? And it could be a quantitative question or a multiple choice question or whatever. All right, so you might have to look at those questions 10 times each. There are online questions as well, and some of those are actually pretty tricky. You really have to think about those, right? So don't just glance over them, right? You really have to apply yourself and appreciate those questions. Okay, I tell you what, let me just make sure. So February 16th, that's next Tuesday, exam 1, chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6. We're not done with 6 yet. All right, so February 16th, 1, 2, 3, and 6 for exam 1. Okay, questions?
The quantitative questions at the end of the chapter.
Uh-huh. Oh, your lab instructors have answers. And I might even have some on Blackboard. I'll check Blackboard to see if those got uploaded, but your lab instructors are familiar with that. But if you send me an email, I'll try to at least give put the answers on Blackboard if they're not there already. I'll try to find out where they are.
Okay.
Yes, because then you can check your work. So that's really good. Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. All right, so why don't you hold the sign-in sheet for a couple minutes and then pass it around. All right, so does anybody have any questions on what we were talking about last time? We're talking about things moving around, down or up concentration gradients. All right, and we actually looked at my nice car, okay, before. So here's my car. To go up the hill, what do you need? Yeah, you need energy, right? So this is an active process, right? You need energy. All right, but if you're on top of the hill and you just give it a little push, it's going to roll down, and that's what we call a passive process. All right, so this is high, all right, this is low. So even in terms of molecular motion, things will move from high concentration to low concentration down their concentration gradient. All right, and then to go up a concentration gradient, you need energy. So what the heck is energy? Anybody know what energy is? What's a good way to think about what energy is? What is energy? Energy, ATP, that's an energy molecule in your body. It contains energy, but what is energy? Does it have a color or whatever? Okay, somebody gave me a pretty good key concept. Energy, right, is something that you have to have in order to do work. All right, so when you have a lot of energy, you can do a lot of work. If you're low on energy, you can't do very much work. All right, so maybe moving this car around, right, is work. To move up the hill, you require energy to move the car up the hill. But going down, right, there's enough potential energy in this car on top of the hill that it can move down the hill by itself. So in the sense, what I want you to realize, when you have a gradient, either a concentration gradient or a gradient here in elevation, there is energy in that gradient. Right, if there is a gradient, there is sufficient energy to move things around. So molecules can move from high concentration to low concentration because inherent in that gradient is energy that can be used to move molecules around. All right, so that's a pretty important kind of concept. I'll mention that a bunch. Right, so there is energy stored in a gradient. All right, I didn't go over this slide last time, but it just shows the difference between a couple chemistry terms, molarity and molality. And I want to go over this really quick. We take, how can we make a one molar solution versus a one molal solution? And we write it a little bit differently. A molar solution is written with a number with a capital M. A molal solution is with a lowercase m. And you should use that convention so that you don't mix people up. All right, so here we have just a balance beam. If we take one mole of glucose, right, and you should be able to calculate what the weight of one mole of glucose is. Right, that's a question at the end of the chapter, for instance. And you would use the periodic table to figure that out. You just count what the number of carbon atoms, multiply it by the atomic mass, right? And then you count up the number of hydrogens that are there, multiply them by the atomic mass, and the number of oxygens in that molecule, and then multiply it by the atomic mass of oxygen. Add that all up, and it's going to come up to be 180 grams, right? That's the weight of 1 mole of glucose. All right, so if we take that mole of glucose and we dissolve it in a 1 liter flask right here, all right, we put the glucose in and then put water in to bring it up to the exact 1 liter mark right here, that's a molar solution. All right, so that doesn't specify the amount of water, right, because some of the volume inside this flask is taken up by the glucose molecules that you put in there. And who knows how much volume that is? I suppose we could calculate it, okay? But nonetheless, that's a molar solution to exactly this 1 liter mark. A molal solution is a little bit different and more important in biology because we're working with dilute solutions all the time. If we take 1 mole of solute, which is 180 grams of glucose, and put it in the beaker, and now add to this beaker exactly 1 liter of water, right, then we see that the flask goes past the 1 liter mark right here because we have some glucose in there as well as exactly 1 liter of water. So that's a little bit more solution in terms of volume compared to the molar solution right here. Okay, and by definition, right, 1 liter of pure water is equal to 1 kilogram. That's how people figured out how to weigh things, right? So if you get exactly 1 liter of water, that's 1 kilogram. So sometimes people use these terms interchangeably. All right, so that's a molal solution. All right, but there's another important consideration, and that is we looked at osmotic pressure. Last time we looked at tonicity, if we could crenate cells or hemolyze cells, right, depending on the concentration of solutes in solution. There's another concern, okay, and that is osmolality. So osmolality is kind of similar to molality, except that when we put certain molecules in solution, they don't stay one molecule. They break apart into a number of different molecules. For instance, if we have NaCl and we put that in water, what happens to NaCl? Yeah, it breaks apart. We say it dissociates into sodium and it dissociates into chloride. So if we have one molecule of NaCl and we put it in water, how many molecules do we have in that water? We got two, right? And that's going to change the osmotic properties of that solution drastically by a factor of two. So the osmolality takes into account dissociation. All right, so if we mix up a solution and put it in this chamber right here with this sliding membrane back and forth, a one molal solution of glucose, right, so we take 180 grams of glucose and dissolve it in the proper amount of water. We have, right, just an Avogadro's number of particles over here on the left-hand side. And then if they take a molal solution of NaCl and put it in water, we don't have the same number of particles as over here because what happens to that sodium chloride? Dissociates, right, we have twice the number of particles. So this is a much more concentrated solution in terms of solute right here, so water is going to move down its concentration gradient from left to right, and when it does, that builds up osmotic pressure, and this membrane is going to move over to the left. Okay, so in this particular case, we're going to have equal pressure on each side of the membrane when we have a 1.5 molal solution of glucose and only a 0.75 molal solution of sodium chloride because why? That sodium chloride actually breaks down into two particles. But water won't diffuse after equilibrium is reached because both sides of the membrane now have a 1.5 osmolar concentration. Okay, 1.5 osmolar glucose and 1.5 osmolar NaCl. And the reason why that is why? Because sodium chloride dissociates into two particles. All right, so we got to be concerned of that with biology. Okay, so what is the osmolality that our body is designed to work around? It's about 300 milliosmolar. So all the particles in solution, not sodium chloride as a molecule, but all sodium ions and chloride ions and calcium ions, if you add all those ions up, right, and proteins in solution and all solutes inside your cells, it's going to be 300 milliosmolar. That's going to be the set point for water balance in your body. Right, so if dehydration occurs, what happens to this number right here? Right, so this is the concentration of solute. So if dehydration occurs, what happens to this number right here? Does it get bigger or smaller? Okay, it increases. Right, so you become more salty as you dehydrate, because when you dehydrate, you're losing water primarily. All right, so this number gets big. All right, and fortunately, there are receptors in your body that can measure osmolality. They're in the hypothalamus. And that's where the set point is. So the set point is 300 milliosmolar. And then the hypothalamus decides what to do. And it's going to work with this flow diagram right here. One of the things that it's going to do is release antidiuretic hormone. Okay, so what does a diuretic do? Yeah, it makes you pee. All right, and when you pee, what happens to water inside your body? You lose it. But what is this initial stimulus? You don't have enough water in your body. So an antidiuretic is going to make you retain water. Instead of lose more water, it's going to keep you from losing water by retaining it. So ADH causes the kidney to conserve water, keep it in your body, but also it's going to give you the sensation of thirst. And when you're thirsty, you're going to drink water. Okay, and so then you'll dilute that salty condition that's building up inside your body. So let's look at this flow diagram. I'm sure this is an exam figure. Okay, so what does the response loop always start with? A stimulus. All right, and what is the stimulus? Dehydration. Let's look at the effects of dehydration. When you lose fluid, your blood volume goes down. All right, and your plasma osmolality increases. It means your blood gets saltier and the blood volume goes down. All right, so there are receptors in the hypothalamus that can detect that. It compares the osmolality of blood, then makes a decision on what to do. The decision is to secrete antidiuretic hormone, which does what? Helps you retain water. All right, because ADH goes from the posterior pituitary, you might be familiar with that from anatomy, I'm not quite sure, all right, from the posterior pituitary to the kidneys, where it has an effect on the kidneys to increase water retention. So instead of producing a diuresis or producing urine, it's going to have the opposite effect, right? Antidiuretic hormone. Your body is going to retain water. Right? The hypothalamus will also give you the sensation of thirst, or you're going to drink. That will increase water intake. That will dilute the salt that's inside your body. Right? That will reduce the osmolality in blood. So then, that is the response. How does the response correspond to this initial stimulus right here? Does it add to it or subtract from it? Subtracts, right? So that's, we have a nice sign, minus sign right here. So what kind of feedback loop is that?
Negative.
That's a nice negative feedback loop. And what does a negative feedback usually do in your body? It maintains homeostasis, right? So that maintains blood osmolality within a range that's suitable to support life. Okay. So this is a really nice diagram. So you should be able to picture this in your mind or maybe draw it out or become familiar with it in some form or another. Okay? All right. Membrane transport. All right, remember, not all things can move across the plasma membrane. Why is that?
Some are too big.
Okay? But don't forget, there's also a large hydrophobic region within the center of the membrane, right? Those fatty acid tails from the phospholipids make up the interior of the membrane. So polar compounds or hydrophilic compounds can't get through that barrier. And maybe you use this around the house. How do you use that? How do you use that lipid membrane around the house? Especially like, for instance, when you're preparing food. How would you use that?
On the pan.
Oh, I say you oil a pan. But I'm thinking specifically as a water barrier to prevent water from going from one place to another place. Did I hear somebody say caviar up there? Maybe I did. Well, for sure, because if you're going to serve some caviar, you like to serve it on what? A nice cracker. And what's the cool thing about a cracker? It's crunchy, right? But if you get a cracker soggy, it's no longer crunchy, right? And if you put caviar in a cracker, and caviar is just a water solution, then the water from the caviar is going to go into the cracker, and you pick it up, and then what are you going to have? A big mess, right? And not just caviar in the cracker. You might want to put some capers on there, a couple of lemon slices or something, which is what? All water. So what do you do to protect that cracker? Put a little butter right on top of the cracker, and then you can put all that watery stuff right on there, and you got a nice cracker for a long time with all that watery stuff on top of it. So that's a nice, what, hydrophobic layer between the water substances and that nice crispy cracker. Okay, so plasma membranes, we're going to see, use that to an important effect. But in order to get polar compounds through the membrane, life has to employ some other kinds of strategies. Right, so molecules too large or polar to diffuse are transported across the cell membrane by the mosaic pieces that are put into the plasma membrane, namely proteins. Okay. All right, so molecules must bind to the membrane protein carriers first before they can be transported. And this kind of transport has three important characteristics. All right, so these are physical proteins inside the membrane. They exhibit specificity. So picture a membrane with a protein inside of it, and it's got to have a binding site for the molecule that's being transported. So we're going to look at this graph right here, which is the concentration of X. This is the molecule that's going to be transported across the cell membrane versus the rate of transport across the membrane. And we see that it changes with the concentration. Okay. So here is something that's pretty important, specificity. Protein transporters will work only with a specific kind of molecule. And the way that you know a molecule will work with this particular transporter is that it has to have the right shape. If it has the wrong kind of shape, it can't bind to the protein, and therefore it can't be transported across the membrane. We call that specificity. All right, so if you have a molecule with a particular shape, and another molecule comes along with a totally different shape, it can't bind to the transporter, and therefore it can't be transported. But if another molecule comes along and it has almost the right kind of shape, it can bind to what? Sort of to the transporter, and sort of can actually be transported, right? So the more similar the shape is, the better the ability is for that transporter to move it across the membrane. The second characteristic is competition among substrates for transport. All right, so if you have a transporter where the site for transport is occupied by another molecule, right, then X cannot be transported across the membrane because there's competition for substrates. Right, and then this last characteristic right here is saturation. When all carriers are occupied, right, then no further increase in transport can take place. One way to think of this is say, well, you have my car, which had two seats in it. Okay? And if there's only one person that wants to get from A to B, they can hop in that car and get from A to B. Right? And if there's two people want to get from A to B, they can hop in the car, no problem. Now, what if there's three people? What's the maximum rate? What's the maximum number of people that can get from A to B?
Two.
And if you have four people, it's still two. So by increasing the number of people, right, that can't increase the rate of transport at all. Okay, so where do we see that on this graph right here? All right, so we're going to look at concentration of X versus the rate of transport. And we see as the concentration increases, what happens to the rate of transport? It increases. It increases, increases, increases. All right, and then it finally reaches a limit right here where even if we increase the concentration of X, all of the transporters are busy doing their job and no further transport or rate of transport can take place. We call that the transport maximum right here, or TM. Let's look and see what happens to the transport maximum if there is competition. So here you have molecule X plus also molecule Y that has a similar kind of shape. It can bind to the transporter, and when it does, it blocks out the availability of that transporter to X. So look what happens to TM. It increases as X increases, but now there is a new level which is lower, so the transport maximum is at a much lower level when Y is present. Why is that? Because Y is occupying those sites that X needs to get to be transported across the membrane. So this decrease in the rate of transport is what we call saturation due to molecule Y right here. All right, so let's look at facilitated diffusion. What the heck is diffusion again? What is diffusion? When a solute moves where? Yeah, moves from high concentration to low concentration. Okay, and don't forget there is energy in that gradient. All right, but facilitated diffusion means that even though a molecule wants to move across the membrane, let's look at this membrane right here. So here we have a nice phospholipid bilayer. We have a high concentration of glucose outside the cell, low concentration inside, but glucose can't get inside the cell because of this significant hydrophobic region right here. Because what can you tell me about glucose? Does it dissolve in water or oil? Water, because of all those hydroxyl groups on it, right? Those are polar covalent bonds. So glucose can't get inside the cell, even though it wants to, because it's at a really high concentration outside the cell. All right, so how do we get glucose inside the cell? Right, we make proteins that can dissolve in the plasma membrane, right, that look like this. And when glucose, and notice that sometimes this protein is open to the outside of the cell, and at other times it's open to the inside of the cell. Right, and it can change configuration or conformation. All right, at rest, the protein has an opening to the outside of the cell that allows glucose to come into basically what? The membrane, right? And it will bind to this transporter. Notice that the shape of this binding site matches up with the shape of the molecule that's being transported. All right, it binds. And remember all the different forces that hold a protein together to give its native conformation. There are van der Waals forces, which are really, really weak. There are hydrogen bonds that are very, very weak, right? So that when this glucose molecule comes in here and binds to this protein, that changes the tension in the molecule and it changes shape. So it changes conformation just by the act of glucose binding to it. And so now it's closed to the outside and it's open to the inside, and then glucose is then diffuses to the inside of the cell. And that's driven by what? The concentration gradient, from high to low. So one way that I think about that change in conformation, say you're sitting there taking notes and your friend is sitting next to you, and in order to demonstrate that change in conformation, your friend takes their finger and jabs you in the side. Okay, what are you going to do? You're going to change conformation, right? So that glucose molecule, when it binds to this protein here, that's like somebody poking you in the side, it's going to change conformation, and this protein has evolved so that it kind of just teeter-totters, open to the outside, open to the inside of the cell. Now, what happens to this mechanism if the glucose concentration is the same on both sides of the membrane? Then no diffusion will take place. No facilitated diffusion will take place. Okay, no net diffusion will go because there is no longer any energy in that gradient. Okay, so these transporters right here are regulated by most cells. And do you have to know the name of these? No. Okay, these are just glucose transporters. We're going to learn some names of these later. Sometimes cells don't have any transporters in the membrane. That means glucose can't get in. Glucose is now trapped where? In the blood. And can't get inside the cell, and those cells are going to starve to death. But if there's a proper signal, right, there are vesicles inside the cell which contain these carrier molecules, and that signal then causes the fusing of this vesicle right here to the plasma membrane. And remember, this is a nice phospholipid bilayer. It will fuse, and then what happens to these carrier molecules? They're placed in the plasma membrane that we see right here. All right, so now these transporters can actually allow glucose to move from high concentration to low concentration. So this right here is what we call an endosome. It stores these transporters and it waits for a signal to put these transporters in the membrane right here. And you know what? You all know the name of that signaling molecule that triggers this response. What hormone do you know causes a decrease in blood glucose when it's given? Okay, and it does it by inserting these transporters, which are in an endosome ready to go to work. Okay, and that again, and you're exactly right, that's insulin. All right, so insulin triggers this response, puts these transporters in the membrane so that cells can take up glucose, thereby lowering blood glucose levels. Okay, so the important concern for you is to understand, is to make sure you know which way molecules move, high concentration to low. Facilitated diffusion needs these special proteins inside the membrane. You should know why glucose can't get in, when glucose transport will stop, right? And then after a while, right, the plasma membrane is always going to be recycled back into the cell and form these endosomes again. And when these transporters are taken out of the plasma membrane, then what happens to glucose uptake by the cell? If these transporters are then put back into the vesicle, the endosome, yeah, then it stops, right? And that happens when, right, when you're in a fasted state, for instance, when your blood glucose goes back down to where it should be. Okay. All right. Active transport, on the other hand, when we look at this slide right here, do we see the use of ATP by this transporter right here? Do you see ATP on that diagram? Okay, so is this active transport or passive transport? It's passive, and it tells you, of course, in the name of this term, right? You should never get diffusion confused with any kind of active transport. But one key way to tell is just to look and see if ATP is being used, right? And is it on the diagram? No, can't be active transport, right? It's got to be some kind of passive transport. Insulin is the key. Another way I think of it is insulin is the passport that allows glucose to enter the cell. All right, and the way that it does that is that it takes these endosomes and places these transporters in the cell membrane. Okay, so that's the job of insulin. So you might realize now, aha, that seems pretty complicated, and you know what? There's more than one kind of diabetes mellitus. One kind is when you don't have insulin. So if there's no insulin signal, these transporters can't be placed in the membrane, even though your cells have them. Another kind of diabetes is when insulin levels are normal, but there is a problem with this mechanism of either building these transporters, right, or inserting them into the membrane. That's called diabetes type 2, right? Diabetes 1 is when you're missing insulin. Diabetes type 2 is when this mechanism goes awry for some reason. And we're learning about that a little bit more every day. Okay. So we'll look, I think in lab, you look at the different kinds of diabetes. We'll talk about it throughout the whole class. All right, active transport. What does it require? ATP. So if you see a diagram and you see transport across a membrane and you see ATP being used, then you know it is active transport. And if it's active transport, which way can molecules go? High to low or low to high? Yeah, it can go either direction, but in this particular case, low to high. All right, so let's think of some membrane proteins once again. Here we have calcium ion, all right, and we have the cytoplasm inside the cell. That's maintained at a low concentration. Outside the cell, calcium ion is at a high concentration. So which way will calcium have a tendency to move all by itself? It's going to have a tendency to diffuse inside the cell. But we need to have it low inside the cell for a number of reasons, and we'll see why. So here is a protein, and again, it can change conformation. It can be open to the inside at one point in time, and it can be open to the outside at another point in time. And what causes this conformation change is that an ATP molecule can bind to this protein, and it can hydrolyze, right, releasing energy into this protein right here. And again, that's like poking you in the side. That's going to change conformation, but this is in a big way because there's a lot of energy in ATP. All right, so calcium can enter this protein, and ATP then is hydrolyzed, causing this change in conformation. So now it is open to the outside, extracellular fluid. So now we have this calcium moving from low concentration to high concentration. This kind of protein that can move ions or other kinds of molecules up a concentration gradient is what we call a pump. And that's kind of nice and easy to appreciate because, say, if you're up over here by my car and you want some water and there's a bunch of water down over here, what do you need to get this water up to you? You need a pump. Okay? So a membrane pump can move some kind of molecule from low concentration to high, but one of the things that you might need is ATP. You need energy to do that. Okay. There's a very important pump, and this pump uses most of the energy in your body. Okay, and it relies on ATP. I don't have on the tip of my tongue exactly what percentage of energy that you use in a day is used by these guys everywhere in your body, but I'll try to find that out, or somebody can do a Google on that. All right, this is what we call the sodium-potassium pump. All right, inside of the cell, well, let's consider two ions, all right, potassium and sodium. And can they move across the membrane? What can you tell me about sodium right here? It's an ion, right? It's a monovalent cation. It's polar. It cannot move across the membrane right here, okay, by itself, just a phospholipid bilayer. And potassium can't either because it's a polar compound. So we can stick a protein molecule right here that moves across the membrane. And if we couple it to ATP, oh, I want to go back a step. All right, so here's inside the cell, here's outside the cell. And in living cells, there is a concentration gradient of potassium. And we see low concentration outside and high concentration inside. So that's just something that you got to memorize. Right? For a normal living cell, where do you have a high concentration of potassium? Is it going to be inside the cell or outside? It's going to be inside the cell, signified by this bold potassium symbol right here. All right? And for a living cell, where do you have a high sodium concentration? It is outside the cell. All right, so that's just something that you got to memorize. We'll see how it develops in just a little bit, okay? But that's something that would be really handy for you to memorize. So how does it get to be high concentration of potassium inside and high concentration of sodium outside the cell? All right, so what do we call a process where something goes from low concentration to high concentration? That's active transport, right? Something going from low concentration, like potassium outside the cell, to high concentration inside the cell. Again, that's active transport. And you require what? ATP to do that. So this is the sodium-potassium pump. It's a special protein in the membrane that uses ATP as an energy source, right, to move both potassium and sodium up their concentration gradients. And notice, it doesn't show it on the illustration, but I have a little bit of text right here. It doesn't pump equal amounts of sodium and potassium. It moves 3 sodiums for every 2 potassium. All right, so that's something else that you should memorize. Okay, now what can you tell me about potassium and sodium right here? They're molecules, but they also have what? An electrical charge on them. All right, so that's like a little current, so you have more positive current, right, leaving the cell compared to entering the cell, right? So we're going to start to eventually in this chapter talk about the electrical properties of cells because of these ions right here. All right, this kind of transport is what we call primary active transport. And primary active transport requires the direct use of ATP, of moving something from low concentration to high concentration. Primary active transport is using ATP. There's another kind of active transport, and we call this secondary active transport. Secondary active transport doesn't directly use ATP, but it uses some other form of energy inside the body. And I mentioned that other form of energy already. Okay, don't forget, my car has energy. Even though it's parked on top of the hill, that's potential energy because where can my car move? It can move down a concentration gradient, right? Eventually, you got to use energy to get it up there, right? And it's stored, and then it can roll down the hill. So let's take a look at this diagram right here. So we got not just one molecule for secondary active transport. We're going to have at least two. All right, so here we're looking at sodium and potassium. Okay. So here we have sodium is one molecule. And what's the other molecule that we're going to look at moving across the membrane?
Glucose.
Yeah, glucose. And what's similar between sodium and glucose right here? Can they diffuse across the membrane by themselves? No, because they're polar compounds, right? So they need some kind of protein transporter inside the membrane. All right, so here we have, let me see if I can look at this slide right here. Here we have a low concentration of sodium, and here's a higher concentration of sodium. Where do you have high concentration of sodium, inside or outside the cell?
Outside.
Outside the cell. So you could actually, you know, I should probably label this outside, right, and inside right here. So how does sodium, how does this gradient develop? By primary active transport that we see on the previous page, it requires energy, right, in terms of the sodium-potassium pump. Right, so here is inside, here's outside. Let me go back. Here's sodium inside the cell, here's sodium outside. It's being pumped out by the sodium-potassium ATP pump, which is primary active transport because you see it using ATP, right? All right, so that protein is pumping sodium outside the cell, so you have a big concentration gradient. It's high outside, low inside. And there is energy in that gradient. What can that energy be used for? Very ingenious kinds of proteins will allow sodium to flow back into the cell, right? So like bring this sodium ball over to the edge of this cliff and drop it. And which way is it going to go all by itself? It's going to rush inside the cell, right, going down its concentration gradient. But here is that membrane protein that's linked to a glucose molecule. And when that ball hits that teeter-totter, look what happens to glucose. It gets thrown into the cell, all right? But it's going from low concentration to high concentration. What do you call going from low to high? Is that active or passive transport? Low to high is
active
transport. It requires some energy. I don't see any ATP being used over here. It's just using the energy in the sodium gradient, so we call that secondary active transport. So glucose can go from low to high, entering the cell, but it requires energy in the form of a chemical gradient. And how did that chemical gradient develop? It developed as a result of primary active transport, the sodium-potassium ATP pump. Okay, developed that gradient. All right, so glucose can be taken up actively by cells as a result of that. Just using the gradient. All right, so if you're going to be looking at an exam figure, for instance, and if you're going to be interested if it's active or primary active transport or secondary active transport, one molecule you want to key on. What molecule are you going to look at? In every case, something is going to go from low concentration to high, requires energy, and how are you going to tell the difference between primary active transport or secondary active transport? If it's primary active transport, it's going to require ATP. That's got to be on the diagram. If there's another molecule that's moving from low to high and you don't see ATP because there's another one that's going from high to low, that is secondary active transport, right? So that's the molecule to key on, ATP. All right, so let's look at a couple different cases of secondary active transport. So in any of these diagrams right here, are you going to see any ATP being used? No. But is energy necessary? Yeah, right? In order to go from low to high, there's got to be some kind of energy required. Okay, so here we have the nice phospholipid bilayer. Got a fancy protein in there, right, which is a transporter. And it's got two binding sites. It's got a binding site for sodium and one for glucose. Now, what is the concentration of sodium outside the cell? A normal, healthy cell. Is it high or low? It's high. Inside the cell is low. So it wants to do what? It wants to rush in the cell, down its concentration gradient. This protein is pretty sophisticated because it can use that energy in the sodium gradient to move glucose from low concentration to high concentration. So when it goes from low to high, that requires energy, right? In this particular case, sodium and glucose, we see, are going in the same direction, right? When two molecules move in the same direction, we call that co-transport or symport, right? Nonetheless, it's still not primary active transport, it's secondary, but both molecules move in the same direction, right? So when sodium and glucose bind to this protein, what should you think of? You're sitting quietly taking notes, and what does somebody do? Pokes you in the side. Changed conformation, so the opening to the outside of the cell closes, the opening to the inside opens up, and now both sodium and glucose can go into the cell. One down its concentration gradient, the other one goes up its concentration gradient. In this particular case, ATP is not used, so we call that secondary active transport. And in particular, co-transport. I like symport. That makes a lot of sense to me. Okay. Counter-transport, I don't think I have a slide. Maybe I have a slide later on. Counter-transport just means that one molecule, okay, moves in one direction while another molecule, the other molecule, moves in the opposite direction. Okay. But nonetheless, there still has to be energy in the form of a concentration gradient to move things around. And as a matter of fact, that's what the sodium concentration gradient really is used for, okay, to move other molecules across membranes that can't otherwise diffuse. Okay, so on this slide, I got a couple terms, and I got a nice exam figure right here as well. Okay, I've got absorption versus reabsorption. Absorption is the transport of digested products that are in your intestine inside your body, right, across the intestinal epithelium into the blood. That's absorption, like absorption of glucose and amino acids and things like that, how they get absorbed to your body. They have to move across an epithelium, right? So here we have like the basolateral part of an epithelium. Here is the apical region of an epithelium. So this is going to be the lumen of some kind of tube, like a digestive tract, right? Reabsorption talks about processes inside the kidney, where fluid is inside a kidney tubule, and if it remains inside a kidney tubule, it's going to be passed as urine, so it's really outside your body. But some of those things inside the kidney tubule, your body really desires. So it wants to take it from the filtrate, and we talked about this in anatomy, which eventually will become urine, takes materials from filtrate that's in a kidney tubule and puts it back into the blood. So we call that reabsorption. Right? So absorption has to do with the digestive tract. Reabsorption has to do with the nephron in particular, right? The kidney tubules. Okay. All right, so here we have an epithelium, okay, and you could consider this either for the digestive tract or for a kidney tubule. And I guess this is really good because here, this is, well, it could be used for either case. Okay, so if material stays in the digestive tract or within the kidney tubule, you're going to lose it from your body, right? Can you have a picture of that? If it's inside your digestive tube or a kidney tubule, you're going to pass it outside of your body. Now, let's say that it's something very important, like, for instance, glucose, right? Because that's an important energy molecule. You can use that to make ATP. You don't want glucose to leave your body ever. Right, under certain circumstances, though, we'll see that it happens, disease processes. Right, so how does glucose go from the lumen of that kidney tubule into the blood? It's going to require a number of different kinds of protein molecules in the membrane. So here's the apical surface. Here is a co-transporter. A co-transporter means that it is secondary active transport, and that two molecules will move in the same direction, okay? And the molecule that's used to develop the gradient is sodium. Where do you have sodium? High outside the cell or inside?
Outside.
High outside. So here is high sodium. Here is low sodium inside this epithelial cell, so sodium wants to enter, right? And it can be coupled with the transport of glucose. Glucose can go from low concentration to high inside the cell, right, using this co-transporter. And have you seen this before anywhere? Ah, right here on this slide. Here it is right here. Right, so here's an example of co-transport. So now you have glucose being reabsorbed or absorbed, depending on the tube, from the lumen inside the cell right here. So now we have sodium entering the cell. How does a cell maintain low sodium inside the cell right here? So that it can run down the concentration gradient from the lumen inside the cell. Well, on the basal surface, you have the sodium-potassium ATP pump. It's going to pump sodium from low concentration inside the cell to higher inside the blood right here. All right, so sodium is going to leave the cell and go into the blood. And now you have high glucose inside the cell, low inside the blood. Which way does glucose want to move? From the cell into the blood, right? That's just diffusion. But can it get across the membrane right here? No, so it needs that special transporter like we saw, okay, which is facilitated diffusion. So glucose can use its own energy in form of the gradient, high inside the cell, low in the blood, for glucose to just diffuse into the blood. So now glucose has gone from the tubule into the blood by these various processes right here. All right, so this one right here, the sodium-potassium ATP pump, would you call that an active process or a passive process? Sodium going from low to high, it's active. Now, what kind of active transport process is it? Is it primary or secondary? Primary or secondary? I hear a lot of secondary. But what's the difference again? Primary, you're going to see ATP being used. Secondary, you're not going to see ATP. Do you see ATP there? Yeah. So is it one or two?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, it's primary active transport, right? The sodium-potassium ATP pump is primary active transport, is driving all of this stuff right here. What about this protein right here on the apical surface? You got sodium going from high to low, while glucose is going from low to high. You see ATP being used right here. Is that primary or secondary active transport? It's secondary active transport. Furthermore, if two molecules move in the same direction, what kind of secondary active transport is that? That's co-transport or symport. Okay, so you should know both of those terms. Co-transport is equal to symport. Antiport, right, is the same as counter-transport mechanisms. All right, so take a deep breath and ask me a question. We're going to change topics a little bit. I think you should be able to follow that, okay? So I gave you some good key things to look at, right? High to low, low to high, ATP being used, not being used, and ATP has energy, but what else has energy? What else has energy that your body can use? Yeah, glucose has energy, can be used to make ATP, but don't forget, a gradient, a concentration gradient has energy. And in just a little bit, you'll see that you have kind of a device like this in your pocket. All right, bulk transport refers to movement of the plasma membrane and movement of vesicles around inside the cell. That means vesicles have to hop a ride on a microtubule to get to the plasma membrane, and when it fuses, whatever inside this vesicle is going to be secreted into the extracellular space. Right, so we call that exocytosis. Endocytosis is just the opposite process where you have motor proteins that are pulling and pushing on the plasma membrane, forming a dimple, which is going to suck material from the extracellular fluid into the space right here, and then finally the membrane is going to pinch off, and then this pinched off piece of membrane will move inside the cell. This is what? If it's particles, that is called phagocytosis. If it's just fluid, that would be called pinocytosis. Yeah, if you want to say pinocytosis, that's fine with me. Okay, so these are opposite, but in order to move the plasma membranes around in that fashion, to use these motor proteins, guess what you need? You need ATP. So this is active transport. Okay, so is bulk transport a form of passive or active transport?
Active.
It's active, because it requires ATP for those microtubules to push all these membranes around. All right. Another topic, membrane potential. And when we use that term potential, you can substitute that term with voltage. All right, and so I'm going to talk about voltage, and it has to do with a voltage associated with the plasma membrane. All right, so we're going to talk about electricity, and a lot of people don't think that you're very electrical, but you know what? You're incredibly electrical beings. Every cell in your body, right, runs on electricity, and we're going to see how that develops. All right, so what devices do you own that contain a voltage? Okay. And is that a good thing? Like what? I have a cell phone. It's electrical. In order to get this cell phone to work, what do I need? I need a battery. Yeah, I have a battery in there. Okay, in order to get your car running, unfortunately mine didn't always have it. You need what? A battery. Okay? And a battery is just some kind of container. All right, it's got a container like this. Let's see if I can find a little bit better marking pen right here. A battery is a container, all right, and essentially it holds, what does a battery hold?
Battery acid.
Yeah, battery acid, nasty stuff, right? It holds electrical charges, what a battery does. It holds electrical charges, all right, and does anybody know how many terminals a battery has? It's got two, okay? And what a battery does is that it puts a bunch of positive charges over here. And guess what it puts over here? Bunch of negative charges. All right? So now you have a gradient of charge. Positive over here, negative over here. And when you have a gradient, what really do you have? You have a form of energy. Right? So battery really is a storage form of energy because it's separating charge. And what can you tell me about these opposite charges? They attract or repel each other? They attract each other so that if we put a wire across this, right, then electricity is going to flow to even out those electrical charges. And then when the charge is equalized, what can you tell me about that battery? Then it's dead, right? Then there's no longer any energy inside that battery. Okay. And we use batteries all the time. So you got to know batteries have two terminals. All right. Here we have a cell. And the cell is made, is directed by the nucleus to put a bunch of proteins, all right, very, very large proteins inside the cell. And all of these proteins have a lot of negative charges on them. These proteins are very large. They can't move across the plasma membrane. These negative charges are stuck inside the cell. Okay, and since they have negative charges, what? They have that electrical property associated with them. What can you tell me about the two ions that we've just been looking at? Sodium and potassium. Those are, I won't go back all the way, those are cations, right? So they want to neutralize this negative charge that's stuck inside the cell, and the plasma membrane has pores in it so that potassium ions, right, can actually diffuse across the plasma membrane. There are pores, there are channels for potassium. All right, so if we don't have any potassium inside the cell and high outside, will potassium want to move in one direction or another? If potassium is at zero inside the cell and really high outside, what can you tell me about potassium? Does it want to move inside the cell? And why does it want to move inside the cell? Let's see if I can diagram this. All right, so let's start with a cell. And let's just pretend it's alive, it's a living cell. All right, just to play a game. So here is the plasma membrane. We've got proteins inside the cell. And what kind of charge do proteins have? Negative charge. No potassium. Now here we have a lot of potassium outside the cell. And there are pores in the membrane so that it can't block potassium. Which way is potassium going to want to move one way or another? It's going to want to go from high to low. What do we call that? Concentration gradient. So potassium wants to enter the cell by the concentration gradient. What else is going to move potassium inside the cell? The charge, right? These negative charges are going to attract this positive charge. So there are two reasons why potassium wants to enter the cell. One is the chemical concentration gradient. I'll just abbreviate that gradient, but also what? The electrical gradient. is going to draw potassium inside the cell. Right, those two effects. All right, case number one. Let's take these proteins out of here. And we got no potassium inside the cell, high outside. We got the pore so that it can go across the membrane. When is diffusion going to stop? Yeah, until you get the same number of potassiums inside and outside, right? Then the gradient disappears. The net diffusion of potassium is going to stop at that particular point in time. What's going to be the difference in charge across the membrane? No difference in charge either, right? You got four positives here, you got four positives over here. No electrical difference in charge, right? But now we're going to look at a real cell. And what does a real cell have? It's got these proteins in here. And what's the charge of these proteins? Negative, right? And you've got thousands and thousands and thousands of these proteins. Okay? So, now you have still an overall negative charge inside the cell. What's going to happen to potassium? The concentration gradient isn't going to draw potassium in, but the electrical gradient is going to draw potassium in to where you have more potassiums inside the cell than outside. Okay, because these proteins are drawing it in. And a new equilibrium is going to be established. And the equilibrium is going to be determined by the electrical properties as well as the concentration. All right, and I think I can go back to this slide over here. All right, so we're not considering sodium right here. We're only considering potassium. Okay? All right, so the equilibrium potential. Potassium can move back and forth across the membrane, but because we have these anions, which we call fixed anions, more potassium enters the cell, right? But not so many that can exactly neutralize this negative charge right here. All right? But since we have these negative charges, we now have a higher concentration of potassium inside the cell compared to outside. Diffusion is going to stop when the attraction of potassium inside the cell due to the electrical properties balances out the force of diffusion for potassium wanting to leave the cell. All right, let me see if I can say that another way. All right, so we got all these negative charges inside the cell. Draws potassium in. And when that happens, we have a low concentration of potassium outside the cell. So which way does potassium want to move by the concentration gradient? So number one, it's going to want to move outside. But there is an opposing force, which is number two right here, is drawing it in. That's the electrical gradient. All right, so that when these two arrows right here are balanced with each other, then there won't be any net diffusion of potassium through the membrane. And when that happens, we see that there is extra negative charge inside the cell compared to the outside. And we can measure that separation, that difference in electrical charge across the membrane. And that device is called a voltmeter. All right, so we can actually put a voltmeter on the outside of the cell and one electrode outside the cell and one inside and measure the voltage just as if you had a little battery in your hand that has two terminals on it. Okay, you can measure the voltage and you're going to see that it's negative inside the cell because of these fixed anions inside the cell. So the concentration of potassium right here develops something which we call the equilibrium potential, right? And that equilibrium potential is going to oppose the movement of potassium trying to diffuse outside the cell. So at equilibrium, there is this electrical potential developed as a result. All right, and when you have something that separates charges from one side of a membrane to the other, What do we call that? That's a battery. All right, so every cell in your body acts as a battery because of that. And the battery, okay, of every cell is about minus 90 millivolts. So you can see that there is a gradient in electrical charge across the cell membrane. So that's an energy source. Okay, let's look at this equation right here. It allows you to calculate what the voltage is based on the difference in ions across the cell membrane. All right, so the equilibrium potential gives you the membrane voltage needed to counteract the concentration forces, right? Because the concentration forces are doing what? Trying to move potassium outside the cell, but the electrical forces are trying to move potassium inside. And at equilibrium, these two have to be equal to each other. At equilibrium, no net diffusion takes place. And we can calculate that voltage that's necessary inside the cell, okay, to counteract diffusion for trying to force potassium outside. And we use the Nernst equation for doing that. So here is the equation. Equilibrium potential for some ion, and we can only use one ion at a time, like sodium or potassium, is equal to this equation right here. And I think you're kind of familiar with this already, because this, what does this kind of remind you of? Maybe the pH equation, where you have that log button right here. Okay. So here, this x in the numerator of the log function is the concentration of an ion outside the cell, and in the denominator, that's the concentration inside the cell. Right? So you got to divide one by the other, divide the outside by the inside, take the log of it, multiply it by this constant right here, 61. But 61 has to be divided by the valence of the ion that you're talking about. So what kind of ion is this potassium right here? It's a cation. In particular, what kind of cation? Is it a monovalent or divalent or trivalent? It's a monovalent cation. So this right here would be equal to Z, which is equal to 1. All right. What about if it was calcium? Then Z would be equal to 2. So in this equation right here, if you're thinking about sodium or potassium, the Z just turns into 1. Right? So that's really easy. And if it's calcium, then you'd put a 2 right there. But we're going to be interested in some other ions, like chlorine. So what would be the Z for chlorine? Minus 1. So that minus sign makes a big difference. Okay, so that's what you would use for Z. All right, so here we have a nice cell, a nice plasma membrane. And this slide is really good because I do want you to know where these different ions what the direction of the gradient is for a cell at rest. I don't want you to know these numbers in particular, but I want you to know where sodium is at a high concentration in a normal living cell. Is it higher outside or inside? Sodium is high outside. What about potassium? It's high inside the cell. What about chlorine? It's high outside, and calcium, it is high outside the cell. All right, so I do want you to know the direction of the gradient right here, and you should be able to calculate the equilibrium potential for each one of these ions individually. So how would you do that? All right, so calculate E, the equilibrium potential for potassium. Here is your equation. What about Z? What would Z be for potassium? It would be 1, so it would just be 61 times the log of this number right here. X outside for potassium is what? 5, and X inside is 150, and these units are the same millimolar, so you don't have to make any conversion, right? So divide 5 by 150, take the log of it, multiply it by minus 1, and that will give you the equilibrium potential in terms of millivolts. All right? And same thing for sodium. Right, so it would be outside would be 145 divided by 12 times 61 because Z is just 1. That would give you the equilibrium potential for sodium. Right, so these are some numbers that you should be able to calculate. Right, so follow these equations. And you might have a calculation like this on the test. So make sure you bring a basic scientific calculator with a log button. And make sure you know when to push the log button. So do this division first, right? Don't do log of 5 and then divide by 150, right? Divide 5 by 150 and then take the log of that and then multiply it by 61 to calculate the membrane voltage. Okay. So it's important for you to know which direction the concentrations vary. All right, so a cell at rest has that voltage across the membrane. We call that the resting membrane potential. You could consider that the resting membrane voltage, the same thing, right? And just like those cell phones and PDAs you have in your pocket that have a battery, all cells have a battery because of sodium and potassium and chloride and calcium, right? And that resting membrane potential can be used by cells to do various things. And from now on, I'm just going to say resting membrane potential is RMP. We're just going to say RMP in here. And probably your lab instructors would be agreeable to that. All right, so RMP for most cells is somewhere in the region of minus 65 to minus 85 millivolts. So that's why we usually say about minus 70 is it for a typical cell. And RMP depends on what? The concentrations of these various ions across the cell membrane. They're not exactly equal. And as a matter of fact, if the concentration of sodium across the cell membrane is equal, what can you tell me about that cell? What about if you have a battery that has equal concentrations of positives over here and positives over here? It's dead. That's exactly right. Right? So if a cell has no resting membrane potential, it's dead. And guess what it needs to develop that resting membrane potential? Let's see if I can go back. What helps develop that, the difference in concentration of sodium and potassium across the cell membrane? ATP, that's right. So when you run out of ATP, this sodium potassium ATP pump stops, the battery dies, and basically that cell is dead as a result of that. Okay. All right, so the resting membrane potential is when the cell isn't doing anything, when it's at rest. All right, so some sodium diffuses in, so the resting membrane potential is a little bit less negative than the equilibrium potential that you can calculate with the Nernst equation. Not a lot of sodium can enter the cell, okay, but some does. All right, so the typical RMP that I want you to know is minus 70 millivolts. All right, so do you think it's, just in passing, do you think anybody ever use a voltmeter to check anything? Yeah, probably like on your car to see if your battery was dead or whatever. If you take an engineering lab or something, use a voltmeter. And it just has two leads and you put it in two different locations. And the two different locations on the cell is just across the cell membrane, one on the outside and one on the inside. So you think it's difficult to build an electrode that you can actually put inside of a cell because cells are really tiny, right? In order to see it, you need a microscope and a pretty good microscope at that. But you know what? It's not really difficult at all because I used to build these all the time. You take some glass tubing and you put it in a Bunsen burner, and what happens to the glass by that inside the Bunsen burner, that flame? It gets really soft. Right, and actually starts to sag. It gets so soft that you can pull the glass tubes apart, and what happens to the glass that was in the flame? It stretches, right? And it does what? It starts to shrink. It gets really, really, really thin. It still has a hole through the center of it and eventually breaks, and where it breaks is now a little microscopic glass tube. And you can take that microscopic glass tube with a microscope and actually put it inside of a cell, and inside that tube put a salt solution, and that will carry electricity, and then you can use that as an electrode inside the cell. So it's pretty easy. The only thing is, what can you tell me about how visible is that little microscopic glass tube? It's invisible, right? So if you poke it around someplace, you got to be really careful where you poke it, because you could be poking it into yourself, and glass doesn't go anywhere, right? Once it's inside your body. So that's how you can make a little electrode right here, right, to measure that membrane potential. All right, so here we have that sodium-potassium ATP pump. We say that it is electrogenic because it pumps different amounts of potassium and sodium. Right? It's only 2 potassiums for every 3 sodiums. So when this pump is working, guess what it does? It helps develop, it adds to the membrane potential. Right? If 3 positive charges leave but only 2 enter, you end up with more negative charges inside the cell as a result of that. Right, so the membrane potential, the RMP, is helped by the sodium-potassium ATP pump. So that's one thing. All right, so these are all of the effects that help develop the resting membrane potential to about minus 70 millivolts. The first thing are these fixed anions. Where do you find these fixed anions? Why do we say they're fixed? They're trapped inside the cell. Right, these are proteins that can't get across the cell membrane, and they have a lot of negative charges on them. All right, so that is going to help attract potassium to the inside, not so much for sodium, because there aren't a lot of channels for sodium, which we call leak channels. Potassium can get across the membrane because there are special proteins in the membrane that allow potassium to move in. All right, and then the second effect is due to the sodium-potassium pump. You have higher sodium on the outside, higher on the inside. So now we have an uneven distribution of ions across the plasma membrane, and you can use the Nernst equation to calculate what those potentials are, and when you add all of the effects together, you get minus 70 millivolts. All right, so that's the resting membrane potential. Bottom line, y'all got to know that every cell acts like a battery, and it's partially due to those anions inside the cell, partially due to unequal permeability of sodium and potassium, and partially due to the sodium-potassium ATP pump, because it pumps unequal amounts of sodium and potassium across the cell. All right, so one of the last topics in this chapter is cell signaling. So how do cells communicate with each other? All right, I don't think I want to draw it on the board because I got a slide right here. But the way cells communicate with each other, there is a general structure that we call a synapse. All right, so cells can communicate with each other through some kind of synapse. And there are 2 kinds of synapses that cells use to talk to each other. One is called an electrical synapse. So if it's an electrical synapse, guess what kind of molecule has to move from one cell to another? If it's electrical, it's got to have some kind of charge on it. What kind of molecules have a charge? Ions. And give me an example of a molecule that has a charge. Give me an example of an ion, like we just talked about. Okay, like for instance, yeah. Potassium, sodium, okay. When, for instance, sodium moves from one cell to another, all right, so let's just say we have a cell right here, and if this cell is at rest, what's the charge on the inside? Negative, and it's going to be more positive on the outside. Okay. Here is a neighboring cell right here. All right, and if for whatever reason, this cell allows sodium to enter, right? And if there is a channel for sodium right here, now we have high sodium with cell number 1. Guess what happens to cell number 2? Sodium enters cell number 1, and it will move down its concentration gradient into cell number 2. Now what happens to the voltage of this cell? It was negative, but as sodium enters, right, then the voltage of the resting membrane potential changes of this cell right here. So this is an example of an electrical synapse, where sodium can go directly from one cell into a neighboring cell. But they got to be touching each other, and it needs a special junction in the membrane. We talked about this in anatomy, but not in terms of sodium necessarily. But there are some of these junctions that act as gaps in the membrane right here. Anybody know what kind of junction that was called? It's actually a pore. It's called a gap junction. Okay? And sodium is going to move through this junction because this neighboring cell right here is negative. So what do we call an electrical charge in motion entering one cell and then going into a neighboring cell? Like if we put a wire across these two terminals, these charges are going to move, right, to neutralize each other. What do we call an electrical charge in motion? That's a current. Yeah. That's an electrical current. So an electrical synapse is a way to stimulate the cell electrically when you have a sodium current entering the cell, and sodium can enter the second cell if it has a gap junction. Does anybody know what kind of cells have a gap junction? Part of an intercalated disc. Where do you find intercalated discs? Like in cardiac muscle, right? So here is a really nice example. I don't know where I got this from, if it's your textbook or anatomy book. Nice phospholipid bilayer. Sodium can't get across, but here we have some membrane proteins that span the distance between the two cells, and then sodium can move down its concentration gradient. All right? And when it does, it changes the electrical properties of this second cell right here. Right? It, what we say, depolarizes the cell, changes the battery nature of it. So that's an electrical synapse. And this is really handy in cardiac cells because they're all connected to each other electrically. So if one cell in your heart gets stimulated, guess what happens to all the cells in your heart? It gets stimulated electrically because sodium can flow from one cell to another to another to another via these gap junctions. Okay, so which type of synapse is a gap junction? It's an electrical synapse. All right, so this is the definition. Sometimes I might ask you this question. What is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? Yeah, and you said it is a synapse. And you got two kinds. The electrical synapse is one. All right, what was the second one?
Chemical.
A chemical synapse. Okay, so here we have a couple of different cells. All right, so here is one cell, and it wants to communicate with these cells down over here. And we see that there is a separation. There's no gap junction between these cells. They're separated. So electrical currents can't flow between these different cells. There has to be another mode of transferring information, and this is an example of a chemical synapse, where this layer of cells is going to release a signaling molecule, and it's going to move by diffusion across this space, and it's going to bump into this cell right here. And if these cells have a receptor, this molecule can bind to a receptor, and it's going to change the behavior of these cells down over here. Right, so information flows from this layer of cells down to this deeper layer as a chemical. So the chemical actually has to move across this gap right here. All right, these cells, and I guess these are red-colored cells, these red-colored cells can respond to these signaling molecules if they have a special protein called a receptor. So if these cells here don't have a receptor, are they going to respond to these signaling molecules? They're going to be completely blind to it, right? So these cells have to have that receptor. All right, and so we call this paracrine signaling, but this would be an example of a chemical synapse. So what must a target cell contain? Oh, we call these target cells, okay, because they can respond to these signaling molecules. What must a target cell contain in order to respond to a signal molecule? They got to have a receptor. All right, what must be the shape of the binding site on the receptor in order for it to bind this signaling molecule? It's got to have a complementary shape. And sometimes we use the lock and key model or the hand and glove model to describe. But the receptor has to be complementary. All right, so on Thursday, we'll finish up this chapter and move on to the next one. Yeah. Okay, at rest. Cell 1 is negative on the inside, cell 2 is negative on the inside. If we stimulate cell number 1 by allowing sodium to enter, that's going to change the electrical properties of this cell. Right? It's going to reduce the battery nature, then sodium is going to enter the second one and it's going to change the battery nature of cell number 2. I mean, if there's membrane was continuous right there? If sodium went in here, it could not get over here. Only this cell would be stimulated. And that's, for instance, how skeletal muscles work. Okay? You can stimulate one muscle cell, but your whole body doesn't contract because you don't have gap junctions. But I'm not sure that's your question.